every day at 5 a.m., I will get up and I will run. And every day I'm tired and I'm cold. My legs hurt from running 6 miles the day before, and the pain will only double after today. People will always question why I do it, because from where they're standing, all they see is the struggle. I heard a saying once that from the bottom of a valley, as you're looking up at a mountain, you can't imagine ever seeing anything more brilliant and perfect. But once you're on the mountain, looking out over the infinite valley below, you can't imagine how you once thought something in this world could be more beautiful than this. I guess it all depends on where you're standing. And from where I'm standing, I see so much more than physical challenge. I see beyond the cold and the pain and the sweat and the tears. I don't see the obstacles like most people do. I see the endless possibility of a new day, an opportunity to make the most of my short time here on this earth. But I can only see this because of where I'm standing. It all depends on your point of view.
It all depends on your point of view. Your point of view will determine how you understand and respond to the life in which you're living. And that's what we're talking about from the book of Esther. So we just welcome you to Hill Country Bible Church. We welcome those of you who are coming to us through one of our other venues. God bless you. We're going to have a great time today. If you're a visitor, we're excited that you're here. If church is not your thing and you showed up anyway, wow. The roof didn't fall in, no lightning strikes, you made it. Glad to have you here today. Welcome. The question is, what is your point of view? What is your point of view? There was a young man of yesteryear who was bringing his date home, and he was thinking to himself, maybe this is the time for the first kiss. As they got out of the car, walked up on the porch, she turned to him beside the door, back to the wall, looked at him with those dreamy eyes, and he thought, yeah, this is going to happen. So with all of his suave, debonair movement, he leans up, puts his hand against the wall, and begins to probe. Could I have a goodnight kiss? Are you crazy, she said. My parents will see us. Oh, come on, who's going to see us at this hour? No, please. Can you imagine if we get caught? Come on, they're all sleeping. No way, it's too risky. Please, I like you so much. No, I like you too, but I just can't. Oh, yes, you can, please. No, I just can't. Please. To their surprise, the porch light went on, the door opened, and there stood the girl's little sister, hair all disheveled, and in a sleepy voice, she said, Dad says to go ahead and give him a kiss. Or I can do it, or if need be, Dad will come down here and do it himself. Whatever you do, tell your date to take his hand off the intercom button. It all depends on your point of view. If you think Dad is listening in, you might say something entirely different than if he's not, right? And if you're in bed and you're trying to sleep and you've got a young teenager on the porch, a little peck on the mouth might not be that big of a deal at this hour. It all depends on your point of view. Some of us operate in life as if God is present and involved moment by moment. But my guess is that most of us operate in life very much like what we see in the book of Esther, where there are no voices from heaven, there are no visions, there are no visible miracles. The name God is not even mentioned. In fact, that may be the workplace you live in, the neighborhood you live in, the school you go to, the friends you hang out with. As far as life is concerned, God is not looking in. He's nowhere to be found. And so you're kind of making it up as you go along. That's what it feels like in this story that we've been studying together. That the people here in the story are not talking about God. They're not mentioning God. In fact, it doesn't even appear that they're following him. Esther and Mordecai, who've taken Babylonian names, have decided that they're going to keep their Jewishness hidden, are not practicing the Old Testament law, have not chosen to go back to the land of Israel like they were supposed to after the captivity, have settled in, and it seems like everything's going great. After Vashti, the queen, chapter 1, kind of told Xerxes off a bit, he kicked her out. Had a beauty pageant for everybody in the empire. In fact, from all 127 provinces, they brought the best-looking women in, and all of them kind of competed for his affection, and Esther not only won the rose and the fantasy suite and the ring, or in her case, the crown, she is now the queen. Mordecai, her uncle, who's been paying attention, taking care of her, is also in a position where he's with the king's officials at the gate, which is the place where all business was transacted. And so he's there. He overhears a plot to kill the king. It proves to be true. He saves the king's life, and he gets his name written down in the record book as a hero. Seems like without any focus on God or paying attention, from their standpoint, everything's going good. And then we come to chapter 3 in the story where we're going to start today. So I'd encourage you to grab a Bible. Let's go there, and we're going to look at chapter 3. In chapter 3, everything changes. The question is, what happens when everything falls apart? I mean, some of you feel real good about your life, and you would say, I feel like I'm where I am and what I'm doing with very little, if no involvement from God at all. I've kind of gotten here on my own. I'm making it on my own. So what's the big deal about God? And we see what happens. In chapter 3, we actually see a grudge between two people that actually turns into a plan that threatens the whole Jewish race. So a grudge turns into a plan that threatens a people. We see this in chapter 3. Look what happens. After these events, King Xerxes honored Haman. Now, here's what's so weird about that. The events of chapter 2, you would think Mordecai, who just saved his life, would be the one who's getting honored. But Mordecai isn't even in the picture. The king picks this other guy to honor. And his name, he's the son of Hammedatha, an Agagite. Now, that Agagite's going to be important in just a minute, elevating him and giving him a seat of honor higher than all of the other nobles. All the royal officials at the king's gate knelt down and paid honor to Haman, for the king had commanded this concerning him. But Mordecai would not kneel down or pay honor him. The royal officials at the king's gate asked Mordecai, why do you disobey the king's command? Day after day they spoke to him, but he refused to comply. Therefore, they told Haman about it to see whether Mordecai's behavior would be tolerated, for he had told them he was a Jew. So Haman gets honored. He gets exalted. The king makes a rule that everybody is going to treat him like the king, bow down when he comes into the room. And every day when he comes through the gate where all the business is being transacted and Mordecai's there, everybody respects him. They bow to him, except Mordecai. And it's so bad that the king's officials begin to argue with Mordecai, saying, why will you not do what the king told you to do? Somehow in the process, he tells them he's a Jew. This is the first time he's revealed that he is actually a Jew to the people that are there. Now, the narrator of the story doesn't tell us why he won't bow. We really don't know. And all we know is he won't bow. Some have speculated because he's Jewish, then he won't bow. But clearly he was bowing to Xerxes, the king. So he's not bowing to Xerxes. There's something about Haman that he is not willing to bow to him. Now, for those of you who just love to study into the details of the Bible, let me just throw something out there for you to think about. He is an Agagite. Mordecai is from the tribe of Benjamin. Mordecai's from the tribe of Benjamin, and his grandfather, Kish, is the same name that the most famous person of the line of Benjamin, Saul, the first king, his father was Kish. So we've got this tracing back to Saul. Haman the Agagite, that's the name of the Amalekite king that Saul did not kill. Go back and study 1 Samuel chapter 15. Not sure if Haman is a descendant from the Amalekites or if the author just wants to heighten that there's been conflict going on for years and years and years between two groups, and here it's coming to a head. Don't know. Speculate on that, but go back and study it. See what you think. Let's move on with the story. So what does Haman do? Verse 5, when Haman saw that Mordecai would not kneel down or pay him honor, he was enraged. He was enraged. How enraged was he? Verse 6, yet having learned who Mordecai's people were, he scorned the idea of killing only Mordecai. Instead, Haman looked for a way to destroy all Mordecai's people, the Jews, throughout the whole kingdom of Xerxes. This guy is so arrogant and so proud that just killing the guy I have a grudge with is not enough. I not only want to kill him, but I want him to die with the knowledge that not only his family, the family of his father, but the family of all of his people all over the empire, all over Xerxes' empire, would include even the Jews back in Palestine, the whole empire. I want this guy to know that he's responsible for the death of every person that has any kind of affiliation with him. You talk about a megalomaniac who's carrying a grudge to exterminate genocide against the Jews. That's Haman. So in the next verse, he makes a plan to do this. In fact, they cast lots to figure out what month and what day that they would carry out this plot. Then he goes to Xerxes and bribes him with 10,000 talents of silver that he says he will pay, kind of blood money, for those who will kill all the Jews. Xerxes says, listen, man, we're good friends. You don't have to pay me that, which usually in that world was like, no, don't worry. It's okay. That's typically how it operated. And the king signs off on it and agrees to wipe everybody out. Watch what happens. In verse 12, it says, on the 13th day of the first month, the royal secretaries were summoned. They wrote out in the script of each province in the language of each people all Haman's orders to the king's satraps, the governors of the various provinces, the nobles of the various people. These were written in the name of King Xerxes himself and sealed with his own ring. In other words, this is going into law. Dispatches were sent by courier to all the king's provinces in order to destroy, kill, and annihilate. Now, that's the wording. We want to destroy them. We want to kill them. We want to annihilate them. Everybody get it? This is what we want to do. Young and old, women and little children on a single day, the 13th day of the 12th month, the month of Adar, and to plunder their goods. In other words, the motivation to motivate people to kill their neighbor is you get to keep all of their stuff. So we're going to wipe out all the Jews on one day in one month in history. Now, the date's about a year off, a little less than a year off. A copy of the text of the edict was to be issued as law in every province and made known to the people of every nationality so they would be ready for that day. So here we have a plot that turns into an actual Persian law. Now, keep in mind, here's why this is so bizarre. I mean, just the whole idea is bizarre, but this is really bizarre. Because in the Persian Empire, they valued inclusion. With 127 provinces stretching all the way from India into Egypt and the Sudan, there were all kinds of different clans and tribes, people groups and kingdoms, and the Persians did well by bringing all of their leaders in and making them part of the kingdom. So bizarre to single out one group of people for extermination. This is so out of the ordinary. Now, we know it's not out of the ordinary in history, because throughout history, we've watched people in power rile up the people in normal life to go after some certain group, vilify them, and genocide has not been uncommon, not only in ancient times, but even in modern times, even in our time. We've seen that kind of thing take place. And so, I want you to see a contrast, verse 15. Spurred on by the king's commands, the couriers went out, and the edict was issued in the citadel of Susa. The king and Haman sat down to drink, but the city of Susa was bewildered. So Haman and King Xerxes are in the palace having cocktails. As far as they're concerned, they just made a law. It's going to eliminate a group of people. No skin off our nose. Let's go to happy hour. In the city of Susa, the people are reading the edict going, what is this? Where did this come from? Why are they going after the Jews? What's this all about? This is so out of the ordinary. Such a difference between the boardrooms and the ballrooms and the throne rooms and life on the street, in the factory, in the shops, in the schools, in the neighborhoods. But there's somebody else in the palace too, where everything is tranquil, everything is peaceful, and everybody just goes to happy hour. And that person is Esther. Chapter 3 is about a grudge that turns into a plan that threatens a people. Chapter 4 is actually about an appeal. Appeal that becomes a call that threatens a queen. An appeal that becomes a call that threatens a queen. Watch how it comes to Esther. Chapter 4, when Mordecai learned of all that had been done, he tore his clothes, put on sackcloth and ashes, and went out into the city wailing loudly and bitterly. That's a symbol. Tearing your clothes, putting on sackcloth, ashes, is a symbol of mourning to get God's attention. And so he's doing that. That's the traditional thing that people would do. It says, but he only went as far as the king's gate because no one clothed in sackcloth was allowed to enter it. In other words, you couldn't come into the citadel close to the palace because you couldn't ever show any disappointment in the presence of Xerxes having foul humor or a bad mood or gloomy in the presence of your king was completely against the law. So he can only come to the gate. Gets to the gate, says the same thing's happening in verse 3. In every province to which the edict and order of the king came, there was great mourning among the Jews with fasting, weeping, and wailing. Many lay in sackcloth and ashes. When Esther's maids and eunuchs came out and told her about Mordecai, she was in great distress. She sent clothes for him to put on instead of sackcloth, but he would not accept them. Then Esther summoned Hathach, one of the king's eunuchs assigned to attend her, and ordered him to find out what was troubling Mordecai and why. She wants him to come in so she can talk to him, but he won't put on regular clothes, so he can't come in. So she sends her eunuch out to find out what was going on. In fact, at this point, everybody in the empire knows, except Esther doesn't know. She's in her little beautiful world behind closed doors where everything is wonderful, or so it seems. So Hathach went out to Mordecai in the open square of the city in front of the king's gate. Mordecai told him everything that had happened to him, including the exact amount of money Haman had promised to pay into the royal treasury for the destruction of the Jews. He also gave him a copy of the text of the edict for their annihilation, which had been published in Susa, to show Esther and explain it to her. He told him to urge her to go into the king's presence and to beg for mercy and plead with him for her people. So for the first time, Esther finds out what is going on, and the appeal is given to her to go into the king's presence and beg for salvation for the people. Watch her response. Hathach went back and reported to Esther what Mordecai had said. Then she instructed him to say to Mordecai, all the king's officials and the people of the royal provinces know that for any man or woman who approaches the king in the inner court without being summoned, the king has but one law, that he be put to death. The only exception to this is for the king to extend the golden scepter to him and spare his life. But 30 days have passed since I was called to go to the king. Now, what Esther tells him here is what I think all of us would do. The first response that we have whenever we're called on to get involved in a risky situation on behalf of other people is to ask the question, how is this going to affect me? What is it going to cost me? What is the risk involved with me? That's a normal human response. And Esther's got good reason to fear. The law to protect the king is nobody walks into the inner court without an invitation and an introduction. Now, this was basic security. People could come and go at will. There were no metal detectors. And so because of that, the king's orders were, if somebody just walks into the inner court, the people standing beside the soldiers were there, were supposed to kill the person right there on the floor in front of everybody without asking any questions. The only exception is if the king held out his scepter and halted. So the first thing that the security would do would be look at the person, look at the king, and then the person was dead. That's how it worked. This is the Persian law, and for good reason. I mean, Xerxes had a lot of enemies. In fact, he'll end up dying in an assassination because he started sleeping with some of his nobles' wives. The guy's a little bit of a pig. He starts sleeping with the nobles. And so he's got reason to fear. Now, their security is a little different than our security. In other words, in their court, you couldn't jump the fence, run across the lawn, enter the residence unscathed. Some of you know what I'm talking about. Others are kind of, can I laugh about that? Yeah, you can. She also says, for the last 30 days, he has not called my name. He hasn't wanted to see me. Now, keep in mind, it's been 4 years since she's become the queen. The honeymoon is over. He's got a whole stable of concubines and a harem. And even though she's favored by him, he isn't looking forward to seeing her. She hasn't been there in 30 days. So what's she going to do? Well, watch the response that she gets back from her uncle Mordecai. Verse 12, when Esther's words were reported to Mordecai, he sent back this answer. Do not think that because you are in the king's house, you alone of all the Jews will be spared or will escape. Sometimes it's more risky to do nothing than it is to roll up your sleeves and take a risk to get involved. Some of the most risky choices in life we'll make are the choices we make to sit on our hands in front of a blatant opportunity to do something that makes a difference, thinking that we're unscathed, that's not going to affect me, it's not going to hurt me, and so I'm just going to let this thing go. And he warns her. He says, listen, do you think that you being a Jew, even though they don't know it yet, will be hidden forever? Watch what he says next. He says, for if you remain silent at this time, relief and deliverance for the Jews will arise from another place, but you and your father's family will perish. In other words, this is very important to understand. He never mentions God, but the implication here is that some divine mover is going to raise up another way of saving the Jewish people. In other words, he's telling Esther, listen, this is not all on you. And that's very important to get that. Because oftentimes, when we step up in a heroic act of faith to do something, if we think we are the ones who are going to save the day, we're not going in the power of God. God is going to accomplish his will in phenomenal ways with us or without us. Much better for us that we're with him than that we're standing in the background. And he warns her, like, we will probably all die, but God will do something somehow to save the people. And then he says these words, these famous words. He says, and who knows, but that you have come to royal position for such a time as this. Who knows that you're in the palace as the queen for this very ordained purpose? To be the one who steps up to speak out on behalf of your people. Now, at this moment, Esther has got to make a decision. And I can imagine the dilemma that's going on in her mind. Think about her dilemma. First of all, she's got to be thinking to herself, Xerxes is okay with getting rid of queens. He's done that before, right? Vashti, he got rid of her. She wouldn't go. So he got rid of her. That's the only reason why I'm here. In addition to that, Persian law is settled law. It can't be changed. They've already made a law to exterminate all these people. What am I going to be able to do to overcome law? I can't overcome that. In addition to that, she's got to be thinking, and the law, about me coming into the palace unannounced and presenting myself, I'm going to get killed as soon as I walk in the door. In addition to that, she's got to be thinking, he hadn't even thought about me for the last 30 days. I wonder who he's been with. I wonder if he even cares about me anymore. I wonder. In addition to that, she's got to be thinking, I'm actually the target of the edict. I can keep my mouth shut and maybe I can hide my Jewishness, but if I come forward and tell everybody and tell the king I'm a Jew, I may get it right there. And he's going to find out that I've been lying to him for our whole relationship, hiding my identity. I mean, that's a pretty convincing case. I can't really do anything. Nothing's going to change. I probably am going to get hurt in the process. Maybe I'll be spared if I keep my mouth shut. All of the justification that you and I use on a daily and a weekly basis to justify doing nothing when the opportunity to do something to help somebody arises or to change something arises. She could have gone through all of that justification. I'm sure she did. We don't know that. But here's what she sent back in verse 15. Then Esther sent this reply to Mordecai, "Go gather together all the Jews who are in Susa and fast for me. Do not eat or drink for 3 days, night or day. I and my maids will fast as you do. When this is done, I will go to the king, and even though it is against the law, and if I perish, I perish." So Mordecai went away and carried out all of Esther's instructions. My life is on the line. I have an opportunity to save others. I'm going to do it. And if I perish, I perish. Now here's the only place in the book that it appears that they're doing something religious, that it appears that she's looking for some kind of divine favor or divine help. Now, what's going to happen? Is this going to work? You got to come back next week to find out. Sorry. And there's a twist in the plot that's going to blow your mind, okay? So right now it looks like Esther can be a hero, but remember, God is the hero of the story. It's going to be interesting. So from our standpoint, we want to apply this because what does this have to do with me? Let me give you three principles in our application here. The first one is this. When we compromise with a dangerous culture, we risk reaping its consequences. When we compromise with a dangerous culture, we risk reaping its consequences. Now, I'm not saying that culture in and of itself is inherently evil, but there are dangers in our culture. And if we compromise with it just to go along and fit in, do we think that the consequences that are coming on our culture will not come on us? For example, I believe that we live in a culture that wars against our relational capacity to love and to engage and to go deeper and to build community. Our culture is one of fast-paced busyness, always achieving, always climbing, and when we're not, we've got technology and entertainment to fill every moment of time. All of that wars against relationships. And so when we see the people in our world who don't really embrace God, don't really have a biblical point of view, and we see them losing ground in their relational capacity, do you think that we're going to escape that? You think we're going to escape that? I mean, people all the time tell me, yeah, I don't really find time to pray and study my Bible. I don't really find time to be involved in using my gifts for the kingdom. Maybe someday, but right now, life is so busy. Do you not think that you will reap the consequences in your soul of every other person that thinks that this is okay, that this is normal? Or at what point in time do you risk being different than the people you work with, the people you go to school with, the people you live in your neighborhood to say, I'm going to take a stand for my own soul. This is not the way I'm going to live my life. I think our culture wars against the family. And as we think about raising kids, our culture values raising kids around three primary needs: their physical need, their emotional needs, and their intellectual needs. But there's a fourth need that's not factored in the flow of life in our culture, and that's the need for spiritual nurture. Do you think that you can run at the pace of everybody around you that is full-time trying to get their kids physically in the game or games, trying to get them emotionally in the game, trying to get them intellectually in the game with all the extracurricular and everything that's going on, and you're going to run at that pace and have no time for real spiritual development, and that you're not going to reap the consequences of that, that we're not going to have kids that don't have that much interest in spiritual things because they didn't see that prioritized in us? I mean, kids have to have time to actually be there, to be at youth group, to be in a D group. How do you do that when you're gone all the time with all these activities? Well, yeah, but you got to understand, you know, my son, he might get a scholarship to play baseball. And so that's why at age 4 and a half, we've got to do this. I mean, guys, I'm not critical of athletics. D1 athlete in my family that scholarshiped all the way through college. But let's ask ourselves the question, can I run at the pace that everybody in the culture runs, which excludes the spiritual, and think that there'll be no consequences? Mordecai and Esther are operating completely outside of the framework of their faith. Think there's no consequences to that? As best I can tell from the story, that it's Mordecai and his bad attitude that sets this thing in motion. Maybe it's something else. That's what it looks like to me. You think that we can operate and not reap the consequences? Two more principles here. We've been challenging us in our own specific situation. If you're looking for God, you got to look longer and you got to look deeper. To look deeper, here's the principle. God places us in the role he plans to use us. God places us in the role he plans to use us. Esther is in the position of royalty. She's the queen. That's the place that God plans to use her. Do you know why you are where you are? The job that you're in? The community that you live in? The neighborhood you live in? The school that you teach in? The school that you attend? Do you know why you're there? I would say if you begin to ask the question, God, show me why you put me where I am, you're going to begin to discover that God's got something special for you to do in the place where you are. He puts you there because he has plans for you there. Second principle, look longer. God prepares us for the part he purposed for us. God prepares us for the part that he purposed for us. One of the qualities of Esther that's so interesting, Esther has the quality of gaining people's favor. Remember when she was first brought into the harem, that the eunuch that led the harem immediately gravitates to her, likes her, and puts her in a favored position? There's something about her with the king, with everybody. Part of it's physical beauty, but there's something about her. She has the ability to win people over. What is her calling going to be? She's got to win these people over, right? And I believe that God has prepared you for something. And you look back at your past. What are the successes and failures? What are the hardships that God's brought you through that have forged your character and your outlook? What are your passions and your gifts? What are the things that you're really good at? That will give you some insight today in how God wants to use you, because He's been preparing you all along for something special. For something special. What is that? What's He calling you to? If we would stop and say, God, you put me here. Help me see what I should be, what I should do, how I should respond. God, you made me this way. Show me how to use it for your glory, the good, the bad, and the ugly. You're going to begin to discover God's purpose for you. But you have to understand, it all comes with a measure of risk. Stepping out of your comfort zone will cause you to exercise your faith. Now, Mordecai said something profound to Esther. He asked the question, who knows? Who knows if you have not come to this royal position for such a time as this? Jesus himself said almost the exact same words about himself and about us. I'd like us to just bow our heads, and I'm going to read his words from John chapter 12, and I want you to listen to his words as he's speaking to himself, and as he's speaking about you as well. Let's bow our heads quietly. Get your heart focused. Listen to these words. Jesus replied, "The hour has come for the Son of Man to be glorified. I tell you the truth, unless a kernel of wheat falls to the ground and dies, it remains only a single seed. But if it dies, it produces many seeds. The man who loves his life will lose it, while the man who hates his life in this world will keep it for eternal life. Whoever serves me must follow me, and where I am, my servant also will be. My Father will honor the one who serves me. And now my heart is troubled. And what shall I say? Father, save me from this hour? No, it was for this very reason I came to this hour. Father, glorify your name. Father, save me from this hour? No, it was for this very reason I came to this hour. Glorify your name." You are sitting at an hour in history. God has a purpose for you. Will you step out and seize it and say, "Father, you glorify your name in me."